generate peace as one God, be free as one God. Let us transcend the boundaries of a delusive self, liberating from superiority complex to inferiority complex, from the equality complex.
So welcome everyone to this day of mindfulness. And there are people here not only from Naples but from other parts of Florida, and toward the end of the day when we have our closing circle and sharing circle, there'll be an opportunity for everyone to introduce themselves and to share a little bit of who you are with each other. How's your practice going? Mindfulness, concentration, relaxing, nourishing. The door is open to us. We just have to let go. For any of us who hold on deeply to our thoughts, to our beliefs, to our judgments, our evaluations, to our self-identity, of who and what we think we are, letting go is not easy. Letting go is scary. Letting go is uncomfortable. Letting go is strange or weird. We are more deeply wound up than we might even believe. We will learn how deeply wound up and attached we are as we attempt to let go. it'll become very obvious. That's what the wonderful thing about the practice, that along the way to full enlightenment, many insights and understandings will arise. And if we are willing to practice honestly and sincerely, these things will become very clear, which is good, because we'll become more personally aware of where the work needs to go on. At a certain point, practice has to become very personal. Some people feel the practice is very becoming impersonal or very detached. No, the practice is very practice is the encounter, on our way to the encounter of reality as it truly is, we will encounter the reality that we have constructed. We will run into the walls of self. And that's good. So please enjoy your practice. And as part of, sometimes you do feel that it's not as easy as it sounds. And if it's not as comfortable as you'd like it to be, practice should shake us up. Practice should turn us around. If your practice is all you're not really practicing. We're skating on the ice. You need to fall through. So before we get into some poetry, some Dharma poetry, just one poem actually, does anybody have any questions about practice? We come together like this for a day of mindfulness. As we practice, we may encounter questions, obstacles, or there may be things that we are bringing from our daily life which represent a problem to us, a challenge to us, that we may not be clear about how to use the tools of Dharma to get us unstuck, unfixated, to reduce our suffering, the suffering we call that others. So lots of things come up. It's good to, acknowledge them and some light needs to be shined on them, not to be shy about that. So, any questions that anyone has? And what is your name again?
You're saying it seems like a lot to hold on to in awareness.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I mean, usually, even though it is in, like, for many of us in our community, involved with the practice of the full awareness of breath sutra, in which those teachings about the breath and using the breath. Basically, the breath is the unifying principle that we use to stabilize and concentrate the mind. But you're absolutely right that, when one begins to enter another realm of experience, the breath and the body awareness will recede to the background or completely recede as one begins to explore. Right? So in other words, coming to mind is sort of like the practice of mindfulness of the breath is the boat, that we move along, but we may pull over and get out of the boat to explore various things. But we always the boat is what kind of is carrying us, and the boat is what we come back to, and the boat kind of is which we primarily float along. that makes sense, right? Because we're using again. I think in that sutra, what you see is that the Buddha recommended. You know, because if you know the sutra, it begins, the first tetra, the first four meditations deal directly with the breath and the body. And then after that, it begins to move out from the breath into the exploration of these other. But he continues to say breathing in and breathing out, and I think that's sort of like that's the ground, the Buddhist training. Because depending on the strength of our concentration and our mindfulness, we can get swept into, swept along with, rather than concentrating on or investigating the nature of the experience of, let's say, sensations or feelings or mind states or mental events or phenomena, because of our habit force, we can just get swept away. Same old, same old. So, you know, having that body-breath awareness gives us a ground to explore from, to come back to, and to kind of keep us. So we don't want to lose that. The practice is simple. We can't make it too complicated. Any other questions? And your name is? Ike? Yes, Ike. Good question. Again, and there are different, you know, if one reads or goes to different traditions or lineages, it's not like everybody practices walking meditation the same. But in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, walking meditation is a very special practice. It's a practice that he personally enjoys very much. Equal to sitting meditation, or perhaps even more so. And so he has really made it very much a very predominant practice. So in his tradition, as opposed to, let's say, other traditions where the emphasis is really particularly on the contact of the foot, heel, toe, or, you know, lifting, you know, say more than the Vipassana tradition, which is a very you know, acute awareness of all the parts of walking. It is much more generalized. It's really, you walk with a sense of ease and a sense of awareness in the entire body, which includes the breath and includes the walking, you know, the contact of the foot with the floor of the earth, but it's not so deliberate. It's not so specific as in other traditions. It's more of a whole body awareness, moving and walking, that's grounded. But again, as Thich Nhat Hanh, again, one of his, not uniqueness, I mean, it's in the Buddhist teaching, but just in terms of his own stress, he stresses enjoyment, which in many traditions is not stress. I think that's, again, one of his gifts, that what is clearly found in the original teachings of the Buddha, which is a joyful effort. And that one practices single-mind mindfulness and concentration, one naturally feels happiness that arises from it. So because one has one let go of all the things that weigh the mind down, burden the mind, as well as one is doing something that is very happy. One is walking freely on the earth, and one is very open to the experience. So you can see that things are smart. So to walk with that sense of mindfulness and concentration, but also to walk with that sense of happiness. You know, how wonderful that I am here. I'm walking on the earth, looking at you,
looking at the trees and looking at how wonderful it is that I have this opportunity to just breathe and drop everything and just be. That makes us happy. So that answer. Any other questions about practice? Yes. Yeah. And your name is? I'm sorry. And your name is what? Simone. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I mean, again, Simone, this is the, again, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you're absolutely right. I mean, so I want to reinforce. You know, traditionally, especially in the meditative traditions of Buddhism, the teachings were and the practices were transmitted teacher to student. Okay? Just the way it goes on in school. Right? So, you know, if you're 5 years old, they don't put you in sixth grade. Okay? You know, and if you go to fifth grade, they don't give you, college math books. Right? And so there is a, there is a sense of development, you know, developmental mind, and the appropriateness of the teaching. And the vehicle for that is the teacher. Right? And hopefully the teacher, even with a classroom of 20 or 30 students, is also somewhat individualizing. Right? The teaching based on the capacity. So again, you know, one of the problems that goes on here in the West these days is, you know, we can access anything. We can be total beginners, and we can access very profound teachings, complicated teachings. You know, we could be interested in meditation, but we could pick up a book on Buddhist philosophy that just blows us away. You know, so without a teacher to guide us, and without a real understanding of the developmental process through the Buddhist teachings. You're right, it's very easy to get confused. So, keep it simple. And again, the first step is mindfulness. Can I begin to live in the present? Can I begin to see reality more clearly? Can I begin to just live my life with a present awareness of what is arising, and can I learn, develop the capacity to take care of myself that as I go through that day, my day, my life, that I can begin to go through it with some calmness, some stability, some openness, some relaxation, some comfort. Right? I mean, that's a good place to begin, isn't it? Right? And as one goes along, one will find some parts of ourselves transform easily, and some parts of ourselves transform less easily. And we'll find there are places within us where we have wounds, and wounds need to be healed. We understand that we begin to need the practice to do some healing. Also places, as we said earlier, along the way, we will definitely encounter self, ego, me, mine, and the various kinds of knots that self and ego tie us up in, that need to be attended to and untied. But
But again, I think Thich Nhat Hanh has a way of saying, you know, mindfulness is the light that gets turned on. Concentration is the the looking glass that kind of lets us focus on things, and then we can begin to look more deeply into the nature of experience, into the nature of mind, into the nature of reality, and discover these nine levels of truth ourselves. Right? I mean, the Buddha didn't make anything up. The masters don't make anything up. They look deeply into the realm of reality, and they report back. And so it's not a matter of intellectually mastering the teaching, so we can regurgitate the 9 of this, and the 16 of that, and the 14 of that, and the, right? It's a matter so we can understand them deeply. The experience of what those words are about. Unfortunately, Simone, healing and transformation do not come quickly. And that is a problem, you know, for us, because we like things to come quickly, and we're impatient, and we just want to get it and move on. Right? We have short attention spans, right? And we're used to instant fulfillment, and you know, we're just kind of, that's kind of the way a lot of us are in program. And that obviously works in more materialistic aspects of life. Unfortunately, when it comes to the type of work that the Buddhist path opens us up, which is really transforming the nature of who, of the way we perceive, the way we think, the way we act, and really begin to heal and transform and untie the knots of our own karma, right, of our own past. It takes time. So along the way, we have to decide whether we're in it for the short run or the long run. Any other questions? So I just want to share a poem, but this poem is just a poem in a big book. this book is called Brilliant Moon. It's called The Autobiography of Jigme Khyentse. Jigme Khyentse, I don't know if you can see his picture. It's quite simply that he was a Buddha. In the Tibetan, from Tibet. And he was acknowledged sort of as a living Buddha by many people within all the major traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, as well as many people who met him. So this is his autobiography. There's another very wonderful book, which is, I didn't bring it, but is anybody familiar with him at all? But there's a wonderful book, which is a book of pictures, and also has a lot of his autobiography. And I forget what that's called. Something like this. Got a beautiful picture on Tibet. That's really quite wonderful. It did much better. It's interspersed with not only stories from his life, but also a lot of his teachings and poems. Also, there are some three or four or five books of his teachings and commentary that have been translated. But he was a Buddha from the old school. He was nearly 7 feet tall. He at a very early age, he had a desire to devote himself to meditation. And actually, I believe he spent at least 20 years in solitary retreat. A great meditator. Might have been 30 years, but at least 20 years. So he was a man of deep realization. Who did the hard work, and yet because of many invitations to please come out of retreat and teach, he eventually devoted himself to more active teaching. he was considered a tireless practitioner and teacher. He would arise every morning at 3 a.m. and just practice, teach. He was a great master of meditation. He was a great scholar, prolific writer, poet, builder of monasteries, constantly had a stream of all types of people, rich, poor, everything else constantly coming to see him that he gave guidance to. He was a tremendous source of nourishment and inspiration to all those who came into him. He was actually a meditation teacher to the Dalai Lama, even though they were from different traditions. So, anyhow, a great life. Right, this is his autobiography, as well as it contains the recollections from family, friends, and students. It's funny, as an autobiography, you may find it less than satisfying. It's interesting. I think for us, we like our autobiography filled with kind of like experiences and juicy details, and what did you really feel about that or think about that, and most of these autobiographies by masters of these traditions tend to be not like that. They tend to really tell you, this happened then, this happened then, this happened then. Then I went on retreat, and I did this practice, and I met this teacher and received these teachings. It's sort of like that. So you can get a real sense of the breadth and the depth of their lives and their practice. And you get some sense of their personhood. But that's not, I think, what we would like. We probably like more anecdotes, in our biographies. But still, it's quite wonderful. And in these, it's also got a section where many of the people who knew him sort of write more personally about their experience with him. So that kind of balances it. Anyhow, at the end of the book, there is a poem, actually called Oral Instruction. And again, these masters, in terms of their training education, they were in very traditional form. So poetry was one of the sciences that they all studied. And so we find that, that many of their teachings were given in this poetic form. They also had forms of singing, so they would spontaneously develop songs about some aspect of teaching or dharma. Let me read through. This is quite profound. People may go deep stuff, but it's good. It's good for us, even if we're not there yet, to practice everything to kind of get a sense of what it's about. So this is just entitled Oral Instruction. Let's see what we can understand. While mind is watching mind, though there is nothing to see, it is vividly clear, uncontrived, free, and at ease in that state, rest naturally, simply, undistracted. Whatever thought occurs from that state, without stopping or analyzing, watch its very nature. If its arising doesn't obscure the absolute nature, whatever occurs, relax right there. Don't follow thoughts about the past. Don't anticipate thoughts about the future. Directly transcend the external world that is called the quote-unquote four parts without three. If you maintain this recognition of thoughts, you will feel that they do not that they do not truly begin, remain, or end, though you notice them. They have no effect on your true nature. That is the bare natural state, the way it is. If you take that empty awareness, open and carefree as the path, all the time during formal practice and afterward, you will quickly and surely acquire a confident realization that confusion is freed by itself. It is very helpful to mingle your mind inseparably with your teachers by settling in equipoise within that state, developing faith and devotion. You will meet the natural face of the Dharmakaya. Especially guard the continuity of impermanence, renunciation, and pure discipline, like your own eyes. Never diminish your one-pointed diligence in the heart of the matter, the essential yoga of the profound meaning. Alternating study, reflection, and meditation, the one will help the others. Ultimately, that is what you need to resolve. So practice the essential meaning with tenacity. May this delightful sacred offering cloud of essential pith instructions cause you to gain realization of the definitive secret that is like space. Is that clear? Does anyone have any questions about this oral instruction? Now, this is the petition. Sankara Rinpoche was a master of what is called the Great Perfection, or in Tibetan it's called Dzogchen Chenmo, often called Dzogchen, the teaching of the Great Perfection. In its essence, it is very close to Zen. And he was a great master of what's called Dzogchen, the Great Tradition. And this teaching represents it. And where he calls his teaching pith instruction. Pith is, the pit, the essential, right? The pit, in the pit, is the whole tree. Right? So in the pith instruction, contained in that little pith teaching, is the whole, is all you need, all we need to work. So these fifth instructions are considered very wonderful because they cut through a lot of the other stuff that has gotten covered over over the centuries within the teaching. It goes right to the essential. So anything strike your mind? I do listen, yes.
What do you mean when
you
said something about
the one of the three? Yeah, I'm not sure what he means. Yeah, the four parts of that, it's in quotation. It obviously refers to some teaching or something in the Tibetan tradition. I'm just guessing, and there are special hells for people who misteach. So to be a teacher and to say something to mislead students, really just getting myself in hot water here that may affect me for a lifetime. So let me just say, I have no idea what this truly means. But I'm just guessing because it is in the paragraph that says, don't follow thoughts about the past. Don't anticipate thoughts about the future, directly transcend the external world. Those are in Buddhism called the three worlds, past, present, and future. Right? So because that is called the four parts without the three. So I'm just guessing, hypothesizing, that what we're talking is about, the four parts are the whole realm of experience. But you pull out this notion of past, present, and future, and all you have left is direct experience, direct awareness, without breaking it up into past, present, and future. So if we run into each other in a special hell in future lifetime, it could come from this interpretation I'm giving you. This is profound stuff. And the Dzogchen teaching is like a lot of the Zen teachings, go right to the heart of the matter. Because you know, in much of Buddhist practice, the way we deal with things is through specific kinds of practices, right? Such as mindfulness practice, such as concentration. There are whole bodies of practice which are kind of antidotes. You know, so when this occurs, do this. Right? And when that occurs, do that. So there's many Buddhist teachings that are like that. You know, look at things in a certain way, do something else, right? Et cetera, on and on. But in this deepest teaching, right? You know, because when we would say confusion, right? I got to do something about confusion, right? And when, you know that when we get confused, we go what? I gotta do something about this confusion. I gotta get rid of it. Or I gotta make it, you know, I gotta bring something else in. I gotta get some clarity. I gotta get rid of this confusion, get some clarity. And, you know, so there's a lot of work in that. But in this teaching, there is nothing separate. There is nothing. There are no opposites. There is no state of confusion as opposed to a state of clarity. And in the world of duality, those are opposites, and they do appear that way. But in essence, what is confusion? When we look deeply at the nature of confusion, we see what? There's no thing called confusion. When we see that there's no thing called confusion, it's just a mind state. And we just let it be, it will wash. It will just unfold in that spaciousness. Usually we think when we have a mind state, especially a mind state, and again, this is a deep teaching. You know, it's easy to read these teachings. It may be not all that difficult to intellectually understand, but it takes a very deep practice to be able to practice. Because usually when quote-unquote negative mind states, right, confusion, greed, anger, hatred, grasping, attachment, delusion, you know, on and on and on, right, arise, our tendency is to be taken over by them. And if we don't do something when they arise, they will take us over and lead to all kinds of difficulty. So therefore, at this level of practice, we are not doing it. We are just letting things arise and disappear without any grasping, without any aversion. And things just naturally dissipate in and of themselves. Things naturally unfold. And one doesn't, at this deep level, one doesn't have to do anything. Right? One is no longer affected by these mind states, because the mind is spacious enough and open enough that they can just arise and pass through. But this is a deep practice. And again, there are many people who run around in all the conditions who espouse these kind of teachings, and yet their minds are still filled with grasping, still full of identification, still full of aversion, and are still pushed by these minds. So, but one is saying, so this gives us a taste that at the deepest level, if one has mindfulness and a deep awareness and a deep relaxation of mind, right? You know, as you've heard me say before, if we could open that door, it's kind of warm in here. I don't know, or maybe we could put down the AC, but I think it's also maybe just the nature of this room. It's quite cool out there. You know, the examples of in the teachings are, and you've heard me, and I'll just say them again because it's good to understand. You know, one way to understand this is, again, if you have a glass of salt, right, and you have a cup of salt, and if you pour it into a gallon of water, you will have what? Salty water, right? And if you take the water, it'll be very clear to you that you have salty water. That salt will immediately affect the taste of that water. In the same way, for most of us, when anger, greed, lust, attachment, aversion, hatred, fear arise in our minds immediately get colored by it. We take on the taste of that emotion. We take on the taste of that impulse. We take on the taste of that desire. Right? And it becomes quite strong and disturbing within us. They're called disturbing emotions. And so, because of that level of disturbance, we need practices that help us deal with it. So we have practices of mindfulness. We have practices of learning how to take care of, to be aware of emotions and how to take care of, and to provide antidotes to that, to calm, to heal, to understand, to look deep. We have all kinds of practices to help us deal with that. Fact that, you know, communication, talking, all kinds of stuff that help us deal with that. On the other hand, if we have a swimming pool, right? And if we pour that cup full of salt in our swimming pool, and let's say it's non-chlorinated, it's a pool full of water, right? So let's say that was out on the lanai, that was a big pool of just water, fresh water. And if we poured a cup of salt in there, and then you picked it up to drink it, how would it taste? You wouldn't taste it. Why? Same amount of salt. The salt is the same. Right? That hasn't changed. But the container of water that it's being poured into has changed. Right? So in the same way, we could say, when our experience of our mind is very small, very constricted, very tight, it's got the container of self, it's got the container of conceptualization. Right? You pour, habitual emotions into it, habitual thoughts into it, habitual mind states into it. And the mind immediately takes on that coloration. But if you have a mind that is free of self-identification, if you have a mind that has been cleansed of the most injurious and penurious afflictive emotions, if you have a mind that is very open and spacious, like the, that cup of salt, the mind will not immediately take on the coloration of that emotion or mindset that has arisen in it. But you got to relax to get that way. Most of us are just too uptight. You have to let go. We have to let go. Let go of self-identification. Let go of identification with thoughts, feelings, perception. We have to let go, let go, let go. And through years of cultivation of awareness and spaciousness of mind, one can begin to really practice at this level. But it doesn't mean that even now these teachings cannot begin to see something within us. I would imagine, you know, it's interesting. You know, oral instruction. See, traditionally, you wouldn't just go, you know, go to Barnes & Noble or go to Amazon.com and get these kinds of teachings. This is the problem, right? So Simone picks these teachings up and she goes, I don't know, Thich Nhat Hanh says just, do mindful breathing. Or the Dalai Lama says to, when this arrives, in Lojong mind training, when this arises, you apply this one, or this one, you apply that one. And, you know, there are 59 of this, and you apply these to the 59 of that, and you know what I'm saying? And you go, what's going on here? Because again, these types of teachings were given orally, or if they were given in a text, they were given to you by your teacher. So your teacher would say, Simone, you know, why don't you read that commentary on so-and-so by Shensi Rinpoche? That's how Simone would find out about it. Okay. It's not as if, you know, oftentimes these teachings are called secret teachings, but they're not like secret teachings like they're being kept secret. You know, like I get a secret, you know what I mean? Unless you give me a certain amount of money or you join my club or, you know, I'm not going to teach you a secret handshake. You know, it's not like that. They were secret in the sense of they were not openly taught. Why? Because a lot of experience and explanation is needed before this will make sense to somebody. Right? Because, you know, Ike says he's a beginner. I mean, I could just go and Ike's just, his mind's all over the place and goes, oh, well, this is great. I don't have to do anything. I can just relax my mind and, just be with my addictions and my, right? Ego and all that. Oh, this is easy. I like Buddhism. Yeah, this is for me. So because it is because to the mind that is not ready to receive these teachings could be harmful. They were not openly taught. Again, the same way. Again, you don't put 5-6 year olds in high school, right? And you don't put middle school kids in PhD programs. One, they don't have a developmental capacity to understand. They may not have also the emotional maturity to do the kind of work that needs to be done at that level. So there's lots of reasons. And again, what you find in Buddhism was this developmental approach, especially in the meditative traditions. But again, because of what's going on in our society, where everything is accessible, books are accessible, teachings are accessible, DVDs are accessible, and really all you have to do is pay money to go to a retreat or so-and-so on these kind of teachings. Right. It's a very different ballgame. And a lot of these teachers, when they first started teaching in the West, they were more, a little circumspect in terms of how they taught. But then, when they realized what was going on here, you know, that it was just totally open and people were teaching Dzogchen and this and that all over the place and everybody's writing books and giving workshops. They kind of get, well, at least, I can teach it, but I'll teach it in a more authentic way. So it's like that, but that traditional way has changed very quickly. Any other interesting things about this?
There was a paragraph on that.
You could talk about that a little bit.
is very helpful to mingle your mind separately with your teachers. By settling in equipoise within that state, developing faith. You know, I think there's even something more interesting, which is the next couple of paragraphs. What I think is fascinating about this is it begins sort of the opposite way the practice actually works. Right? He begins with deep meditative instructions about the mind and watching the mind and how to develop and be in this mind of profound awareness and spaciousness. And then as he goes on, he says, and then it's good to mingle your mind with your teachers. And then he goes on and talks about impermanence, renunciation, and pure discipline. And you need to guard the continuity of that. And then he talks about the importance of study, reflection, and meditation, and that you need to practice with tenacity. You know what I'm saying? He it usually goes the other way. It's sort of like he begins at the top and he works down to the foundation, right? As opposed to beginning on the bottom floor and working up to the top, to the penthouse. It's kind of like he drops us into the penthouse and then he kind of shows us all the other floors right down to the basement. Which I think is wonderful. Because what he's doing, and again, a lot of these kind of short texts were written or spoken in relationship to a specific request. So this might have been a student or somebody comes to him and says, Rinpoche, can you give me instruction in the nature of mind? Or can you give me instruction in Dzogchen? You know, like that. Or it could be direct or it could be in a letter. He receives a letter. Remember, this was no telephone. Remember those days? No telephone. You couldn't just pick up the telephone and talk to somebody. You couldn't just Skype somebody. You couldn't, you know what I mean? You couldn't even, right? So you either had to go to the teacher directly for teaching, or else you could write letters to them, giving them your questions, and they would write back to you. So that's why you find, you know, for many of these great teachers, that there is a significant about matter of teaching available from them, because a lot of what they did, they wrote. Right? It wasn't recorded. So they had to, you know, either write it down in a text, or they were constantly writing letters to their students. Right? So I would imagine this oral instruction was a teaching that he gave in relationship to a request for somebody, you know, Rinpoche, you know, please teach me about the nature of mind. Rinpoche, what is the essence of the Dzogchen path? You know what I mean? Or something, you know, like in the Zen tradition, you know, what is the highest teaching of Buddhism? What is why did Bodhidharma come from the West? You know, these kinds of questions. Right? So, what I think is really wonderful about this is he begins directly giving these profound teachings on the mind and the nature of mind to the students, right? He responds to him or her very directly and openly and wonderfully. And then goes, but don't forget. One needs to do this, right? And you find all great teachers. They are very much aware of what needs to be done. Right? I mean, one can't have a penthouse without a basement, or at least a good, strong foundation. You can't have a penthouse without a first floor and a second floor, right? You can't just have a penthouse floating up there. Right? So even to get to the penthouse, you do have to go, right? You have to go in the entrance, you know, either the elevator or the stairway. And whether you're taking an elevator that stops at every floor, or whether you got one of those, you know, direct elevators that go right to the penthouse,
You still got to, you know, you still got to go up floor by floor. And Rinpoche, Chinchin Rinpoche is telling his students, don't forget. So to me, we can just read it the other way, from a practice point of view. He begins with realization, and then he reminds of all the stages that have to be done through that support that. So there's a method to his madness, right? It's sort of like it's sort of like if you wanted to get somebody to climb a 20,000 foot arduous journey. So you may begin by what? Showing them these beautiful pictures, what it's like at the top, right? Showing them the views from the top, the vast views as you look out of these endless vistas. Right? This is the view from the top of the mountain. And you go, wonderful view. I like that. Spacious awareness. Things just untie themselves. I like that. Then once you're hooked, you're told, well, you know, you start you start at base camp, and then you load up your 60-pound, 80-pound pack, and you walk for these many days and through this kind of terrain, right? Oh. We just got what? To just go right to the top. So if we turn it around, and we begin at the end and go toward the beginning, he begins by saying, it's his bodhicitta. May this delightful sacred offering cloud of essential pith instructions cause you to gain realization of the definitive secret that is life space. So this is really his wish. That these teachings I'm now going to give you of essential pith instructions may be the cause of your realization. So the last paragraph is really the first. And then he says, alternating study, reflection, and meditation, one will help the other. So this, you know, goes back to the Buddha. You've heard me say it many times, and you hear all Buddhist teachers say this, that one needs to some degree, to study the teachings. One needs to reflect on the teachings so one has a personal intellectual understanding of what they mean. We're not just parroting words, but we understand them intellectually. We reflect on them. And finally, we meditate, which really means we practice it. So alternating study, reflection, meditation, one will help the other. Especially guard the continuity of impermanence, renunciation, and pure discipline like your own eyes. Right? We guard our eyes, don't we? Very carefully. Right? If there's a windstorm, or if there's somebody throws something, we without even thought, we what? We protect our eyes. Why? Because we value our sight. You know, if all of a sudden Carol picked up a bunch of sand and threw it at me, I would probably not go like this. Right? I wouldn't cover my chest. I don't want the sand to cover my chest. Right? I'd go like this. Right? Why do we do that? Because here are the things that are most essential to us. Right? So he says, it's a wonderful image. Guard the continuity of impermanence, renunciation, and pure discipline like your own eyes. Never diminish your one point of diligence in the heart of the matter.
the essential yoga of the profound meaning. So again, the container in which we are diligently practicing the essential yoga of profound meaning, the container is the understanding of impermanence, renunciation, and pure discipline. Pure discipline is what? Five mindfulness training? Precepts? Precepts, Bodhisattva precepts, 14 mindfulness trainings, order into being. This is discipline. Buddhism is called Vinaya. Vinaya. Right? And there are various disciplines and commitments for lay people, for monks, for nuns, for bodhisattvas versus non-bodhisattvas. So, you know, take seriously your vows. Take seriously your commitments, guard them like your eyes. Be impeccable in your practice of the discipline. Don't show me shy. If one has committed oneself to a path, follow through it. But we're always looking for wiggle room. Well, this is the way. No, this is the way I do it. Be impeccable in your practice. Discipline. Renunciation is an interesting word. Again, renunciation has to do with renunciation has to do with what? Saying no. Right? To renounce something is to do what? Right? How would you define renunciation? So renunciation is simply, there are things we have to say no to. Not because they're inherently bad or evil, but why? Because they're not good for us. Because they cause suffering to our bodies or to our minds, because they're causing suffering to others. Because they screw up our life. Because they take away our energy from what we want to do. So, there are many things we have to say no to. Certain kinds of activities, certain kinds of people, certain kinds of temptations. Not because they're bad, but because where they lead to is either a place of pain and suffering, or they lead to a place of that's generally unsatisfactory when we look at the bigger picture, or they're just wasteful. You know, they just don't produce anything of meaning. So renunciation, to one degree or another, is part of the path. But again, the best kind of renunciation, the best renunciation, comes from the inside. Right? Not something that's forced upon us, because when things are forced upon us, often we what? We resist. We're not happy. And that's when we start wiggling. Right? So the best type of renunciation is where it is clear understanding and seeing. I know this is not good for me. I know this is toxic for my body. I know this is not good for my health, mental health, physical health. I know this is not good for my family. I know this kind of behavior, this kind of action is only harming my relationships and not really nurturing them. Right? We're all Nancy Reagan. Just say no. There might have been greater wisdom there than we that's okay. You know, if you're saying no to things is unhappy, you're unhappy, you know, if it causes you suffering or you're fighting with it, then it's really not healthy. But you should say no with joy. Huh? You know what I mean? Because you know you're giving up something that's not good for you. That's harmful. So why, you know, the shedding of your attachment to things that are not good for you or that take your energy away from where you want to place it, again, should be something that feels good for you. The path of quote-unquote renunciation is not, you know, the path of the hair shirt and the self-flagellation and, you know, denial, you know, you're just denying yourself everything. So there's always struggle. You know, you read about a lot of the old saints, and so, you know, they were just in such mental agony, right? This constant mental agony because they actually, again, I mean, I don't want to judge them. I mean, they're definitely a good place. But that's not what this path, especially as a lay person. Our renunciation has to be a lot more sophisticated and based on clear seeing. Rather than, you know, somehow a morally superior, you know, I'm giving this stuff up. You know, a lot of people, it's just ego building. Identity strengthening. Right, regarding the continuity and permanence, again, is saying, as we all know, we've talked many, many times about this, you know, the capacity to clearly see impermanence, clearly see, you know, the non-self basis of impermanence is like the fundamental view in the Buddha Dharma. Because to see impermanence, to see our own self, almost immediately allows us to let go, not hold on. But to see clearly what's unfolding, that it's just an unfolding. And I can't control it. And I can't own it. And I just have to be with it. So impermanence is very free. To see impermanence is very free. Again, this thing about working our way up to the teacher, this is very much in the Vajrayana. It's a particular, but it's really in Zen. I mean, it's really, it's just a little different. In the Vajrayana teaching, which primarily is the form of Buddhism that really developed very strongly in Tibet, less strongly in other Mahayana Buddhist countries, much less. So you find it mostly in the Tibetan culture, the centrality of the teacher, but the centrality of the guru. And the absolute identification with the teacher. But in this sense, because this is the Dzogchen, he says, helpful to mingle your mind inseparably with your teachers. So this is not guru worship and guru devotion, is it? Which is in the traditional sense. But this is not what he's saying here. He's not that aspect of the guru yoga or guru tradition is not what he's saying here. Mingle your mind with your teacher's mind. Well, what is your teacher's mind? Is it the mind of understanding? Is it the mind of compassion? Is it the mind of loving kindness? Is it the mind of clarity? Is that what you perceive to be the teacher's mind? Whether your teacher is a living teacher or a Buddha or whatever you want. So if you have a clear sense of your teacher's mind, mingle it inseparably with yours. Is that clear? So that's what this is about. What is it? And in the deeper teachings of the Vajrayana, that is what's taught. It's not an external teacher, it's not an external form. It's really the mind of. You know. And you know,
people might say, Thich Nhat Hanh is my teacher, the Dalai Lama is my teacher. People talk this way. So, you know, what is the mind of the Dalai Lama? What is the mind of Thich Nhat Hanh? Right? You depersonalize it and you look at the, you know, the understanding and the qualities of mind that the teacher has. And if you hold that teacher dear to you, mingle your mind with those qualities, with those understandings, and make them your own. And then the practice of mingling your mind with a teacher, loving your teacher, and all that has profound inner meaning. It is the inner Buddha, not the outer Buddha. And then, having done all that, one can begin to set into the meditator. Right? The empty awareness, opening carefree as a path. What does that mean to take empty awareness, opening carefree as a path, all the time during formal practice and afterward? Open and carefree. Anybody here want to be open and carefree? And to make that your path? No. No. Well, what is open and carefree other than your awareness? I'm aware of you, I'm aware of you, I'm aware of you, I'm aware of you, I'm aware of the sound, I'm aware of the trees, I'm aware of that. All those things are what? All the things named are objects of awareness. When we're always lost or attached or seeing reality as the object of awareness, we will not be open and carefree. But the thing that links all those experiences is awareness. If one takes awareness as the object of one's meditation, then one can be open and carefree. Because in awareness, things are just arising and passing away. From endlessly arising and passing. Uh-oh.
Saying is that there should be no attachment. And if there's no attachment, that's it.
That is what the Buddha teaches.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But that, you know, capacity to be non-attached and be free, you know, is a deep practice. Because it's not just only, you know, it's not just the easy stuff. I have to go, well, you know, I'm not attached to my things, I understand. And I'm not attached to the people in my life, you know, I'm not much freer with that. But, you know, the profound non-attachment that is being referred to here means I am not attached to anything, including thoughts, feelings, perceptions, ego states, identities, you know, anything. That I am willing to let go of it all and just live. Totally open to whatever, without any attachment to outcome. Now, obviously, you know, to go off deep into the mountains, and let go of all the all the things of the world and all that, all of a sudden it makes things much simpler. As lay people who are in the world, it is a much well, it is certainly, it's harder just because there's just more going on, more attachment, more things.
But it doesn't mean that, you know, Chenpo Rinpoche, by the way, had a wife and children. Even though he was head of a monastery and had many, many monastic disciples, he actually had a wife and had children. So there's hope for you, Michael. And he was a big guy, too. He was much bigger than you. Well, again, Michael, you know, in his autobiography, he really doesn't go into the nature of his relationship with his family. That's what we're looking for. Mind is watching mind. Though there is nothing to see, it is vividly clear. Uncontrived, free, and at ease in this state, rest naturally, simply, undistracted. Whatever thought occurs from that state, without stopping or analyzing, watch its very nature. Its arising does not obscure the absolute nature. Whatever occurs, relax right there. Don't follow thoughts about the past. Don't anticipate thoughts about the future. Directly transcend the external world that is called the four parts without three. If you maintain this recognition of thoughts, you will feel that they do not truly begin, remain, or end. Though you notice them, they have no effect on your true nature. That is the bare natural state, the way it is. If you take that empty awareness, open and carefree as the path, all the time, during formal practice and afterward, you will quickly and surely acquire a confident realization that confusion is freed by itself. It is very helpful to mingle your mind inseparably with your teachers by settling in equipoise within that state, developing faith and devotion. You will meet the natural face of Dharmakaya. Especially guard the continuity of impermanence, renunciation, and pure discipline like your own eyes. Never diminish your one-pointed diligence in the heart of the matter, the essential yoga of the profound meaning. Alternating study, reflection, and meditation, the one will help the others. Ultimately, that is what you need to resolve. So practice the essential meaning with tenacity. May this delightful sacred offering cloud of essential fifth instructions cause you to gain realization of the definitive secret that is like space. So, some oral instructions from Chenpo Rinpoche. So we'll stop here.